Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Anofawakin.
This week, is it the end of Bitcoin? A massive security flaw for Apple? Comcast strong-arms Netflix? Facebook's WhatsApp gets VoIP? And the internet is fucked? But is there anything we can do about it? As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com. All of our subscription links are in our show notes, and you can leave us a review if you sign up on iTunes. We really want to hear from you. Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down, and please write us at comments@thedrilldown.com. Leave us a review on iTunes. Leave a reply in our show notes. We just want to hear from you. Our show's also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. We're going to go straight into headlines. So this week, the Bitcoin community was on edge as a leaked document showed that the Mt. Gox exchange, a longtime pillar of the virtual currency and arguably the largest exchange of the currency, was missing hundreds of millions of dollars worth of customer money and headed for bankruptcy. The document said that Mt. Gox had lost 744,000 Bitcoins due to theft and included a table indicating that the company is in the red for tens of millions of dollars in fiat currencies such as dollars or yens, as well as millions of Bitcoins. The Mt. Gox site initially shut down upon this news, but is recently back up, but for now only consists of a brief statement saying, quote, a decision was taken to close all transactions for the time being in order to protect the site and its users. Meanwhile, a joint statement by Bitcoin industry leaders, including the founders of Coinbase, reacting to the fall of Mt. Gox, assured investors that the, quote, tragic violation of trust of users of Mt. Gox was the result of one company's actions and does not reflect the resilience or value of Bitcoin in the digital currency industry. As with any new industry, they say, there are certain bad actors that need to be weeded out, and that is what we're seeing today. I don't know. Does this give you any further confidence? Does this bolster your confidence in Bitcoin and bolster your confidence in cryptocurrency or digital currency in general? Or is this a sign that this is the end of this particular digital currency?
So here's the thing. The big thing about digital currency is actually the same thing as the copyright debate. How do you maintain a digital item in only one place at once, right? Bitcoin heavily relies on connectivity. So when I give you a Bitcoin to buy something, Andy, yeah. The record, which is public, says that the Bitcoin that I gave you with the serial number XYZABC is now in your possession and no longer in my possession. That solves a lot of problems. That's how you can have money that is cryptocurrency. The problem here was that that updated record takes some time. It's like when you transfer money in a bank and it takes a day or so for me to like actually get that PayPal money to you. It takes a bit of time for the record to be updated. So what did they do? In order to for them to move as quickly as they did as they normally did and become this huge exchange, they had a secondary record, sort of a quick note-taking ledger. Mm-hmm. The ledger said, I give you a Bitcoin. It's like, I'm down for giving Andy a Bitcoin. Okay, we're going to assign it a number, and Andy gets that number. So when this hack happened, they weren't breaking Bitcoin. They were breaking Mt. Gox's secondary identifier. They went in, and they basically said, I'm going to say I'm going to give Andy this Bitcoin, but not really give Andy this Bitcoin. And that's really how they began breaking that down. They basically made it so that they were taking Bitcoins and messing with the sort of impromptu secondary transfer situation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these Bitcoins, basically it's almost as like you're stopping the truck before it delivers the money truck before it makes its delivery to the bank.
Yeah.
So Bitcoin never registered that these coins were transferred, but the site did. So people were like transferring stuff and they didn't realize that the transfer wasn't happening. It was going to somebody else and not going to the person that it was supposed to go to. And that's really how they pulled it off. Given that scenario, is Bitcoin doomed? No. But this style of exchange is not useful. It's not going to be okay. It's obsolete. Sure. Bitcoin needs to work with these exchanges in order to make the transactions happen more quickly. So then using these patchy ways of sort of getting around the delay of the update of the Bitcoin ledger. And that's really the issue here.
Yeah, I mean, I think a major part of this issue is not really, you know, the end of Bitcoin, but more the issues around Mt. Gox. As you probably heard from the various articles, even the other sort of, I don't want to say founders of Bitcoin, but maybe we say the council, of Bitcoin, the council of middle Bitcoin. even the council just, I think, didn't really have much faith or support for that organization. And I think, you know, it further brings credence to who do you actually trust and who should you actually back. Now, it seems like they are taking the correct steps as a community to reassure everyone else of this currency. And I think it's going to be just fine in terms of its resilience. But I sort of wonder if this could more or less be the death of Mt. Gox more than anything.
Yeah, it's a good question. I know that Mt. Gox's insolvency isn't giving U.S. lawmakers any confidence. Senator Charles Schumer, as we know, 3 years ago shut down the Silk Road and cited Silk Road's black market use of Bitcoin for anonymous transactions. And in a letter this week, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew, Fed Chairwoman Janet Yellen, and other financial regulators, in a letter to them, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin demanded that they take appropriate action to limit the abilities of the highly unstable currency. This virtual currency, he said, is currently unregulated and has allowed users to participate in illicit activities while also being highly unstable and disruptive to our clearance.
It's disruptive, that's right. The fact is, Bitcoin, from a federal government perspective, is pretty much like barter. We're bartering. It's not illegal to barter. It's not quite a currency yet, and it is global. Certain countries have rules against second currencies. The United States doesn't. Just like how we don't have a straight-up rule against, like, speaking Spanish or something.
Yeah.
So the disruptive part is that, you know, he doesn't get it. The disruptive part is that it doesn't track like normal, like the dollar. But it also shows a significant risk. When you go to Bitcoin, you go to Mt. Gox, you go to these places, and these things happen, your relief is not going to rest with the Secret Service the way it would if there was a huge, you know, money copying scandal. You know, like if someone was counterfeiting greenbacks, then the Secret Service would get involved, but they don't get involved with Bitcoin. So what we're seeing is the lack of regulation, the lack of a central bank, the things that make currency weak generally also protect it and make it somewhat strong. So this is part of a trade-off of, you know, standing on the bleeding edge of payment services.
I feel like Bitcoin or really any sort of cryptocurrency, any digital currency, won't achieve a true legitimization until they have worked out fail safes to limit the amount of risk, to limit the ability of people to to essentially jump in and wipe out people's bank accounts.
I mean, maybe, but let's just remember that the FDIC didn't start insuring the money that you keep in a bank until well into the 1900s. I think, in fact, it was part of the Depression in order to keep the bank solvent. And the U.S. dollar, it gained legitimacy before then. Bitcoin's legitimacy comes from the fact that it is regularly created, like the gold standard dollar used to be regularly created. So I think that its legitimacy it's shown up. There are businesses, big businesses, hotels and other places that are using Bitcoin as payment. It's legitimate payment for certain things. It is tender. I just feel like some people may be uncomfortable with it because it doesn't have the backing of the U.S. federal government. But then again, that's what makes it in many ways stronger than any other nationally backed currency. But I want to put out there, Bitcoin is a legitimate way to transact business. It is not illegitimate. It has gained legitimacy.
What do you see as like the watershed event for Bitcoin in order to pass in order to hit the comfort level of U.S. lawmakers?
Well, I think with any currency, it's time and its performance. People are mostly scared because it's risen so quickly. That means it could fall quickly. But the fact is, there are major, corporations that are accepting Bitcoin as payment. And as long as they continue to do so, it's a simple word of mouth. Hey, man, I use Bitcoin. I don't have to get taxed. Hey, man, I use Bitcoin because my money gets there immediately. Hey, man, I'm a business and I use Bitcoin because I'm not getting charged 2 or 3% by a credit card for this online transaction. Hey, man, I use Bitcoin because I'm in Romania and I make this really cute thing and all these Americans want to buy it, but their credit cards are denying the purchase because it's coming to Romania. So I use Bitcoin because I'm not losing 30% of my purchases. Or maybe I'm Amazon and I use Bitcoin because 10% of my purchases are being stopped, or 8% because credit card companies think that they're fraudulent purchases. Bitcoin solves those things. If you can add 10% to your business by changing the way you're doing the means of the transaction, you're going to do it. And that's what makes Bitcoin – that was the watershed moment when these companies said, look, I'm going to give this a shot. And people started buying with it. It's got to grow slowly. I don't think there's no hero moment. There's no hero person. It's not like how when Richard Gere decided to become a Buddhist, it became legitimate in like the in Hollywood. I really think it's one of those things where crypto. Are you laughing?
It was a great analogy with the Richard Gere thing.
So, I think the bottom line is that cryptocurrency is a child of a crowd-based internet. And the tipping point isn't one that happens at a single moment. It's one that grows over time as the crowd begins to understand the value of this currency or not and begins to use it. There'll be a moment and someone will look at it in hindsight and say, oh, we saw 5% of transactions in the year 2015. Or the year 2018, let's call it. We saw 5% of all our transactions happening in the year 2018. Bitcoin has taken off. And then someone else, 50 years later, will be like, well, in the year 2025, 35% of all transactions were with cryptocurrency, whether it's Bitcoin or not. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the arriving date. But I think there's going to be a steady progress. If Bitcoin fails, it doesn't mean that this movement will go away. I think, listen, people are definitely going to want to use it, but there are crazy legitimate business reasons for the use of Bitcoin. And chiefly, it's because it's far more efficient than the credit systems that we use today.
I mean, let's just move to Doge because it's still going pretty strong.
There's also Litecoin also, too. Just not to forget, there are other cryptocurrencies out there, and Bitcoin is just the one of many.
Yeah, it's become the thermos or the Kleenex.
Yeah.
Of cryptocurrency, but
I saw mentions of Bitcoin show up in the series Almost Human on Fox over the last few episodes. I think they've mentioned Bitcoin like 2 or 3 times because this is a series that takes place in the future, 30 years in the future, And supposedly Bitcoin is a common currency by then.
It should just be a choice like other things.
Yeah.
Cash, credit, Bitcoin, PayPal.
Okay, moving on here. On the heels of its $16 billion deal to be purchased by Facebook, WhatsApp announced on Monday that it would start offering free voice services later this year, diversifying beyond its main messaging service into phone calls. Speaking at the Mobile World Congress conference in Barcelona, the tech company's chief executive, Jan Koum, said users in the second quarter will be able to make internet calls to their smartphones similar to services that are already available on rival internet messaging offerings like Kakao of South Korea or Viber of Cyprus. WhatsApp voice service is expected to be available first on Google's Android and Apple's iOS operating systems, and then expand to Windows Phone and BlackBerry. This is WhatsApp's move to be Skype. And I have to wonder if Facebook knew about this. Obviously, they had to have known about this before they purchased WhatsApp. This was on their radar.
Yes and no. I mean, I believe Facebook Messenger allows for voice communication right now.
But nobody uses it.
That's true, because it's Facebook Messenger.
Right.
It's a branding problem.
Yes. So WhatsApp, you already have this.
Have access to Facebook's army of engineers to move forward.
Yeah.
WhatsApp's its biggest kind of drawing point is that it's internationally used for messaging.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you take that Facebook voice over IP technology and fold it into the existing WhatsApp user base, we'll begin to see some traction there for Facebook.
Right.
And I think that's why they can make a statement so quickly out the gate. They have the engineers. They have the technology. It's just going to cost a little time to integrate it properly and fully. They also have to make sure that they're able to do this without compromising the privacy and security that people have come to love WhatsApp for. They don't keep any data on you right now.
Right.
Will they do it?
Privacy also, and security has not been something that is generally associated with Facebook.
Privacy is definitely an issue that Facebook, you know, it has been fighting time and again. But frankly, it's been winning on that issue for a long time. They push the envelope, and people have tried to push back. But in the end, app.da and all these other things are not taking off. There's no Facebook alternative in the aggregate. Pieces like WhatsApp are showing up and taking, you know, pieces of it away. Let's also remember that, you know, Facebook has its Messenger app. It also had its camera app right before it got Instagram. Its Messenger app, it has WhatsApp. So there's definitely synergies to be made. I can see the Facebook Messenger app going the way of the dodo now that WhatsApp is where it is.
Yeah. 465 million monthly users WhatsApp has currently. And I didn't realize until doing some research on WhatsApp that they're far bigger globally than they are here in the U.S.,
That's their chief thing. If you're in Saudi Arabia and you got a friend in the U.S., you WhatsApp them instead of paying the $6 for a text message. It's an exaggeration on the cost of a text message, but you get what I'm saying. So you're able to use it. And if you can take that and start using your voice or even like a FaceTime video chat type thing, you're in good shape. They're currently charging $1 a year for unlimited use. If that went up to $5 a year for unlimited use of texting plus radio, plus voice communication.
Mm-hmm. It's still a good price. $5 a year.
Yeah. I mean, they'd have to make those economics work, but the fact is, there's probably a way to beat the Skype prices.
Yeah.
Who's that? WhatsApp currently has no plans, from what I've read, to connect directly to voice telephone communication, meaning right now on Skype, I can open up Skype and call your phone number, Andy.
Right.
I don't see anything in WhatsApp that allows me to do that yet.
Right. All right, moving on here. So for several months, Apple's software has been severely compromised by a security bug that allows would-be hackers to supposedly encrypted information over Safari web browser. Matthew Green, a cryptography professor at Johns Hopkins University, said it's as bad as you can imagine. and Apple released an emergency update for the iPhone, the iPad on Friday. But 2 days later, privacy researcher Ashkan Soltani listed on Twitter a list of apps that he said has also been affected, including Mail, Twitter, and even Apple software's updating mechanism. Researchers at Google and security firm CrowdStrike have recommended users to avoid Safari and untrusted communal wireless networks, such as the ones in restaurants and coffee shops.
Of course they have.
Yeah.
Those using Mac computers for which an update still hasn't been released currently have few options for secure communications. So the patch has been... Apple released the patch for the iOS, but it's still the...
So I actually believe the patch for Mac was released either this morning or last night. So there was a patch for Maverick.
You got to remember that. Yeah, and there's also a patch for iOS isn't just a patch for iOS 7. They're so serious about this, they released iOS 6.16. Wow. So for those older devices that don't have access to iOS 7, like the iPhone 4, or rather the 3GS, you can still gain access to, you know, secure communications. One of the funny things about this is that this has been going on for like a year and a half.
And nobody knew about it.
Well, somebody knew about it, presumably, but they didn't, like the leadership at Apple didn't know. So the hole was built into iOS 6, and when iOS 7 showed up, which looks very different, and it's apparently sitting on the same bones, it had the hole in it as well. For me, it was slightly annoying because, you know, I have a couple devices that are iOS 7 compatible that I had not upgraded to iOS 7 yet because, frankly, you know, iOS 6, I got some love for iOS 6. With a hole like this and the fact that you can't change your default browser from Safari on an iOS device, boom, there you go. iOS 7.06 across everything I own. One of the interesting things, too, is that people were complaining that there was no OS X patch for a while. You have to realize it's the same engineers. So the engineers jumped on. They made this iOS patch because they have so many more iOS devices out there. And because you can't have a different browser as a default.
I am seeing a new update for OS X, but there is nothing in the... Nothing in the notes mentioning what the update...
The security update. The update for iOS 7 and iOS 6.16 said security and you know, encryption around whatever. This update for OS X does not. So I'm not sure if it's related or whatever. I just do know that the same engineers that are fixing the problem for iOS 6 are also the ones that have to work on OS X.
Ah.
And because of that, you know, while Apple obviously can walk and chew gum at the same time,
right,
you're going to take your experts in fixing this problem and apply them to the other side. Again, Apple has many more tens of millions of iOS devices than they have OS X devices.
Sure.
That's why iOS gets the priority. So let's just keep that in mind. It's definitely an embarrassing thing. Now, I would like to know how many times, I don't know, I wonder how equitable this is with the Windows security patches I see on my Windows computer during every Windows update. Every single description is, prevents a malicious attacker from taking control of your computer by insert whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, this is not someone taking advantage of taking control of a phone, but on par with those sorts of attacks, you know, how does this stack up? I mean, it does mean that your stuff was open. If you're on a Starbucks network and there's a dangerous person there,
right,
you're going to be able to look at everything you're transacting, which is definitely not great. So
how drastic are the average Windows update patches? I mean, Windows update patches, did they fix security problems that are as drastic as what this Apple one has been described as?
They're smaller. They're smaller scope. But there's so many of them, you do have to wonder. Also, I think we've all gotten to the point where with Windows, oh, there's a security patch, it's so mundane. But Apple, security patch, oh no, we better talk about it.
Right. I mean, if you also think about it, there have been a lot of big patches out there of late. There was the whole flash issue. as well as Android has had its share of security, you know, woes that have needed to be addressed. So I don't think it's something it's unique in the sense that, you know, this is something that affects all iOS devices. Mm-hmm. And I think the first thing we really should know is if you have an iPhone or an Apple device, you should really keep up. Actually, any device, you should really keep up to date with the patches that are available.
Yeah.
Yes and no. I mean, if they do a major update of an OS, I mean, they've done the tests. Updating your iPad 2 to iOS 7 makes Safari launch slower. Parts of Safari will run faster, but, you know, apps are going to run slower. So if you're the kind of person who's sitting in your house on your Wi-Fi, and it's a secure Wi-Fi, nobody else is on it, then you have a lot less to worry about than if you're running around with an old phone out in the wild. So, well, I think that people should definitely think about, I mean, you should be cognizant of what you have updated and what you haven't. Running out to update to the newest thing is definitely not what I would advise for most consumers, especially because oftentimes, you know, when a new OS rolls out, it's got all sorts of hiccups and hangups, and people are complaining about bricked phones and all that stuff. And
right. Well, I think, you know, what we really mean there is not major upgrades, but anything security related. So being more specific, if there's a security update that's available for your version, that is something that you should, you know, really invest in. So.
Yeah, I would also say that having had some issues with having spoken to Apple personnel, if you're going to do a big update, you definitely want to do it through the computer. You don't want to do it through Wi-Fi. For whatever reason, the verification process on Wi-Fi is not as robust, let's call it, as the one through the computer.
Uh-huh.
The computer gets the whole thing and then passes it onto the phone. I've had people at Apple tell me, well, make sure you're sitting closer to your router when you update. And I'm like, are you kidding me? That matters? Apparently it does. So
it's a good point, considering one of the apps listed as being affected is Apple's updating mechanism.
Right. So if you can do it through the computer, do it through the computer. I would always advise plug it in, make the backup, store your phone to factory settings with the newest OS, and then put your backup back on your phone. I know it takes more time, it's less convenient, but you'll have less crashes, you'll have less issues. Guaranteed.
All right, let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week is called The Future of the Mind, The Scientific Quest to Understand, Enhance, and Empower the Mind by Michio Kaku. In this book, he looks at the research being done in top laboratories around the world, all based around the latest advancements in neuroscience and physics. He takes a grand tour of what the future might hold, giving us not only a solid sense of how the brain functions, but also how these technologies will change our daily lives. He even presents a radically new way of thinking about consciousness and applies it to provide fresh insight into mental illness, artificial intelligence, and alien consciousness. I like Michio Kaku because he's very down to earth. He has a very sort of layman's way of explaining the arcane nature of physics to
physics has an arcane nature?
It does to some people like me.
You're saying you think this guy Michio Kaku is a bigger deal than our friend Neil deGrasse Tyson?
He is about on the level of Neil deGrasse. Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson is an astrophysicist. Michio Kaku is a physicist. And they are about on par with each other.
All right.
Yeah, so if you've ever...
So he's going to be in a Superman comic. That's what Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Well, I would recommend, if you ever get the chance, just go to YouTube and just type in Michio Kaku and
have to spell that for me.
Sure.
In the show notes.
Obviously. In the show notes. It'll all be in the show notes. But just check out some of his work that he's done. It's really fascinating stuff. To get that or any one of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. And you can also get the free 30-day trial to check out their service. You still get to keep the book, even if you don't like the service. audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. All right, we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, is your ISP extorting content providers like Netflix for more cash? Take a listen to this and come on back. Just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at some of the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakin. So, just a week after Comcast's acquisition of Time Warner Cable, Netflix has agreed to pay Comcast to ensure Netflix movies and TV shows stream smoothly to Comcast customers in a landmark pact that could set a precedent for Netflix's dealings with other broadband providers. In exchange for payment, Netflix will get direct access to Comcast's broadband network. The decision comes amid growing signs that congestion deep in the internet is causing interruptions for customers trying to stream Netflix movies and TV shows. Netflix CEO Reed Hastings reportedly didn't want streaming speeds to deteriorate further and become a bigger problem for customers. For the past year, Netflix, which has more than 30 million paid subscribers in the U.S., has been in a standoff with all the major broadband providers, including Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, and Time Warner Cable. Netflix wanted to connect its specialized servers free of charge to the providers' networks, arguing that such a link would improve streaming quality for the customers. And Netflix has won such arguments in smaller broadband providers, including Cablevision, as well as operators overseas, but major U.S. providers, including Comcast, wanted to be paid for the connections because of the heavy load of traffic Netflix sends through their networks. In the wake of this deal with Comcast, Netflix is likely to agree to compensate with the other big providers. Netflix has historically routed its streaming content to broadband providers through a number of internet middlemen, but since 2012, it's been trying to reduce what it pays these middlemen by getting broadband companies to hook up directly to its new video distribution network without paying them fees for carrying its traffic. A lot of people are reporting that this feels like, you know, like extortion, essentially, like Comcast bending Netflix over a barrel to allow them more open access, more a broader channel.
I know it's not exactly that, but it feels like net neutrality is over. clearly, they've been talking for some time, and the net neutrality decision that was just handed down didn't play directly into this, but I get the sense that what we're seeing is, you know, Netflix has a pretty intense infrastructure in order to get all these 30 million people, all this music. If you've ever run a website off of your computer, you know it's like when you have 30,000 hits, 3,000 hits, much less 30 million. And this is, you know, rich media coming off in what's considered HD. So given the amount of Comcast subscribers that are using Netflix, you know, Netflix made the deal. It goes also to show that these Comcast, either the size of Comcast is just that big, or for whatever reason, Comcast subscribers are using Netflix because Comcast doesn't have the content that they want. Regardless, Reed Hastings has known for years now that streaming is the future of his company, so much so that he invented Quixtar.
Right.
And he cannot afford for some upstart company, you know, Redbox has a streaming service now,
sure,
whatever, to show up and be like, hey, we've got some of what Netflix has. Amazon's got crazy infrastructure as well. He can't be outcompeted in that level. If that means paying, then so be it.
Yeah, it seems like it does seem like they've got them over a barrel.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because on one hand, these are the sort of negotiations that Netflix already has, right? So Netflix already has partners, and even Apple has the similar partners with folks like Akamai and whatnot in terms of distributing their content. So it only, I guess, ultimately as a business, it makes sense going forward to really partner with, you know, with Comcast, with the organizations that directly impact your user base. I guess what will really depend is just how this sort of interconnection plays on, you know, whether or not Comcast tries to be the bully in the scenario rather than a partner. And I think that's one of those things that's going to be really difficult and only time will tell. And I also think it might essentially even be may depend on what happens with this potential merger, right? I think that could play a huge role in how Comcast tends to view itself.
I think what we're seeing also, I mean, I agree with you, Tosin, is that the reason this is as big a story as it is because of the upcoming, you know, potential merger.
Right.
In light of the fact that Comcast, you know, like you said, Cablevision's Optimum Online, which is always ranked in the top, the very top of customer satisfaction, they already made the deal with Netflix for no money. They were like, hey, we want our customers to be really happy, really happy. So, I mean, they're New Yorkers, and that matters because they will speak out. We want our customers to be really happy. So, yeah, we'll go with the direct connection. Yeah, why not, right? Meanwhile, Comcast is in a very different, bargaining position. They're like, you know what? Screw you. We want money if we're going to connect with you directly. I don't know how much more it costs Comcast to connect with Netflix directly, but I don't imagine that once the data gets to Comcast internal network, it's really taking them out. Regardless, the fact of the matter is that given the upcoming merger, we really do have to see, you know, Comcast has to play a lot of PR games to make sure that the Department of Justice and popular opinion doesn't truly turn against them. Or else they won't get this merger done, and they won't be able to be the super big content fish in the sea that they'd like to be, which will, you know, effectively be able to compete with Netflix and Amazon in new ways.
I'm wondering, you bring up a good point about the merger of Comcast and Time Warner Cable, and how, because they're effectively going to create the largest group of subscribers by a long shot, by eclipsing whatever comes in second. I guess it would be Verizon at that point.
It's like Verizon and AT&T deciding that they want to get together to make AT&T Verizon, and then the next biggest company is Sprint or T-Mobile. Right. The next biggest company is T-Mobile. It's a huge disparity between the top two.
Yeah. So how will that affect, considering that Netflix takes up an average of 30% of all internet traffic during peak hours, how that will affect how they are able to bargain with Comcast and the new Comcast / Time Warner in the future, you know, what sort of leverage they'll have.
Fairness aside, Comcast / Time Warner will be able to say, you know what, we're not going to give you access to old episodes of this TV show or that TV show, because we want people looking at our network during the peak hours.
Sure.
Maybe peak hours are going to cost Netflix more money. So subscribers are going to have to start paying extra money if they want to watch a Netflix show at 8 o'clock or 10 o'clock or whatever.
And Comcast
just don't know.
Comcast has their own streaming service as well that you could that is directly a direct competitor with Netflix. And
it
and,
isn't. It isn't. It's a streaming service if you have cable. Xfinity, I have it. It basically, I mean, they've partnered with a million people, and if you have cable, you can stream multiple. You know, you can on-demand stuff. You can do whatever. But I haven't yet seen a service that stands alone from having a cable subscription, mm-hmm. a cable box in your home, a cord cut situation that Comcast offers. I haven't seen that yet.
But that's the other.
And I would love it if it were there because, frankly, the cable box is the bane of my existence. No, it's not true. I have bigger things in my existence that are a bane. But the cable box is, in terms of my entertainment experience, it's a very large device. It gets very hot.
Yeah.
It doesn't offer a lot. The channel surfing is terrible. Like, really, if they had just partnered up with Microsoft and the Xbox One or Sony and the PlayStation 4, that would have solved everybody's problems. But they're still holding on to this old model and this old box, and it's really painful.
Well, that's the other question is that, you know, it's in Comcast's best interest, Comcast / Time Warner, if they merge. If they're a cable company, and it's in their best interest to do everything they can to avoid becoming just a dumb data pipe company.
Yeah, they can't just become a delivery situation. They have to have the content, which is why they bought NBC. NBC Universal was purchased by Comcast from GE. And it's why they're, you know, that Time Warner so keen on getting with them between all of them. I mean, Warner owns HBO. So that's something to keep in mind. You have one company owning all the stuff on NBC, all the stuff on HBO. And then you've got another company, Disney, owning all the stuff on ABC, ABC Family, all those other channels. And then you've got Netflix, which is basically, it's been pimping out those, and Amazon too, they've been pimping out those guys up for years because those guys were like, what do you mean? Streaming? Yeah, whatever. Who cares? No one likes streaming anyway. And now suddenly, streaming is the hotness, and they want to reclaim their content and push that piece. That's the challenge that Netflix is up against. And that's why they're so bullish on creating their own content. Those guys, Netflix is basically trying to become, I mean, I think it was their chief content officer who said, we have to become HBO before HBO becomes us. Because everybody understands
right.
that streaming is what the people want. You know,
speaking
it's not a question
of
prime time, let me hang out with my buddies and like wait around on TV until the show comes on. People want to stream when they want to stream. They want to watch it on their phone. They want to watch it wherever, you know?
Speaking of large content companies and streaming, did you see that Disney had started up their own streaming service called Disney Movies Anywhere?
Yeah, Disney Movies Anywhere. It's they've linked it to their Disney Rewards program, which is basically, if you own a Disney movie already, you sign up for the rewards program and you get, you know, some online perks. You get to kind of register your film, and you know, you get hookups and updates when different releases of different films and so on are going to come out. You know, what's coming out of the vault and everything. Now they've basically said, look, we're partnered with Apple.
Yeah.
And if you buy one of our movies on Apple or buy it through us, it's available on all of your Apple devices through their videos app, or you can stream it, you know, for download, or you can stream it through our app.
Yep.
And that allows you to gain access to our content. And I got to say, I was pretty excited when this came out. And I think I might have texted you that I'm basically going to be spending $20 every month on a different Disney movie until I have all the ones that I'm a fan of.
You did. I wasn't sure if you were being facetious or genuine. But
I mean, that content is content that helps define who we are as in my generation, for sure.
And full disclosure, I do work for Disney.
That's true. You do. So there's that. So I'll just be lining your pockets. But the bottom line is...
Not my pockets, personally.
I start looking at stuff like, you know, Sleeping Beauty, all that stuff. And finding it digitally has always been a problem for me. I don't know if I told you, but a couple of weeks ago, I was looking for some Disney stuff. And, you know, Netflix has an Amazon. I think they have, like, The Rescuers and some of that.
Yeah,
you know, like Sleeping Beauty, which is you know, a great movie, but it isn't as popular as some of the other stuff. But anything out of the golden age, the renaissance of Disney from the 90s, you know, Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, that's the kind of stuff you just want to be able to pull up and whatever. You're always talking about it, you know, always having little arguments about it. Would love to just be able to pull it up and say, no, this is what happened in the scene, dude. And that's kind of what's going to be around. It also matters because, you know, we're at this age now where people are having children, and this is a great time to take that content and share it with, you know, your babies. This is what mommy looked at when she was a little girl. This is what daddy was interested in when he was a little girl. I mean, daddy was a little boy probably. But you get my point. The ability to share this stuff with the younger generation is going to help just cement that bond between parent and child, especially in an age where the generation gaps only can get wider because technology moves faster and faster and faster. Think about all the kids today who are sitting, you know, growing up with an iPad in front of them and their parents who are like, whoa, I was just happy that I had dial-up connection. And their parents who are like, we used to go to sock hops. You know what I mean? there are these huge, huge changes in our culture. And if we can use this content to bridge that gap, to make it, you know, help it remain universal, we're going to be doing ourselves a favor. And I think Disney service, you know, this service is a good one. Granted, Disney could have done this earlier, but they're Disney and they figured out how to make the money on their own. That's what's great about them.
Yeah, they're always on top of ways to maximize the content.
Monetization of their content.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's an art form over there. Okay, so moving on here. Historically, Apple has always relied on CDN providers Akamai and Level 3 to deliver Apple-related content, including apps, iTunes video, and software updates for their platforms. But for the past few months, those in the networking community have been discussing some of the new people Apple has recently hired, all of whom seem to have a deep background in building out large-scale networks. The idea is that they're rumored to be perhaps working on their own CDN.
It's content distribution network.
It's the storehouse where everything gets distributed out of. Like Apple puts all their content in the CDN. And then they send it out from the CDN to everyone's individual devices.
Yeah, the fulfillment center. Sort of like, you know, Amazon is a fulfillment center. You're a small business. Your product is fulfilled by Amazon. You basically keep it in an Amazon warehouse. That's what's up. And, you know, Apple is one of the biggest vertically integrated companies in the world, especially when it comes, you know, when it comes to their hardware. Now it looks like they're trying to become vertically integrated when it comes to their software. How do you save money in a world that's all about content?
Yeah.
You make sure that you can deliver your content on your own without help or hindrance from anybody else. It's interesting that they looked at this and they said, look, we don't want to buy Akamai because they could do that.
Yeah.
But Akamai does a lot more than CDN stuff. They're, you know, a huge data collector and provider for advertisers and all stuff that Apple, I think, doesn't really want to get into, doesn't see itself in its corporate image. So they're like, how can we bring people on? Now, if Apple calls you up and says, hey, do you want to join us? There are not many people in the business world who will say no, especially when it comes to people in the content distribution space. Because really, content distribution, content creation, it really comes down to who has money, and Apple has a ton of it. So they're going to be able to poach whoever they want. And it'll be interesting to see how quickly they develop this. And if they take their trademark doing it the Apple way approach to it, or if it's more of a more conventional sort of content distribution network.
Either way, Apple wins because they're not paying somebody else.
Right. It depends. If they have a whole bunch of cronies and it's like unreliable or something, then people will move over. Amazon has a content distribution network in place, as I understand it. So, you know, Apple's trying to catch up with them on some level. Is this a prelude to a more robust Apple content offering? You know, spend $500 a year and gain access to everything in Apple's library, something like that, you know?
Oh, interesting.
That would be the kind of thing that would disrupt the current situation. I mean, mm-hmm. if you're paying cable $110 a month, that's, you know, what is that? That's the $1,300 a year. And if Apple can do it for less than that, because they've got the clout to talk to these content distributors, then they're going to be in a far better place. The biggest thing, the theme I think we've noticed tonight is that, you know, cable is running the show in an incredibly inefficient manner vis-a-vis both the technology and the consumer's needs and wants. That's why this Netflix thing is news, because Netflix is delivering things, you know, the way people want. That's why they're blowing up. Apple is running into the same – is also likewise figuring out how to deliver content to people in a way that they want. And if they can find a way to disrupt cable, they have the clout and they have the tie with Disney. That'd be huge.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely it seems to be sort of a running theme of Apple in the last few years is that they are they're snatching up, along with Google too, snatching up the vertical integration on all of their core competencies, so that they don't have to rely on other companies to provide the the vertical services. They just they buy it all and they deliver it all themselves.
Yeah, there's something. I mean, again, Apple and Samsung on the hardware side are the biggest vertically integrated companies around. If they can bring distribution in-house, they're going to save a ton of money. And they're going to make a ton of money eventually. So that's helpful, especially when it comes to, I mean, I don't know how the music business is doing for them. I mean, there's been talk about how it's slowing down and everything, but the video business is only growing for everybody.
Yeah.
And that's really what it comes down to. If they can begin to deliver, and if they can, frankly, if Apple can begin to deliver video on devices other than Apple devices, meaning, you know, I know right now you can obviously, if you have a Windows machine, you can use iTunes to get Apple content, Apple distributed content. But if they can get on, you know, God forbid, if they can get their distributed content on other mobile devices, let's say the Android devices and everything, then it'll be a slam dunk for them, because people want their products. They can't always get their hardware products because they're expensive or whatever. But reliability, security, these are things that, you know, despite this recent breach situation, Apple's pretty much really well known for. So if they can grab that piece of the pie, you know, their stock price should go up, and they should do pretty well.
Here's an interesting thought. You know, Apple already has original iTunes content when they do. They'll put on concerts and offer the music exclusively through iTunes. I wonder if they're going to start doing video content, like producing their own video content the same way that Netflix and Amazon does.
It's not their cup of tea, I don't think. I think Apple's kind of content to be a purveyor. They know that because of the reach of their products, they can gain access to the content for the purposes of resale. That's why they don't have a straight-up streaming solution yet, because the idea that they'll be able to, hey, I got a platform, I got, you know, 500 million people on it, I can sell your stuff, you got to go through my store. People are like, yes, but they can also buy it online. And Apple's like, yeah, they can, but it's going to be tricky to get it into our stuff, and that's how they're going to consume it, yada, yada, yada. Building out their own content gets in the way of that focus on, hey, you make the content, we sell the content. Because that way they get a piece of every pie. If they go into the whole, we're going to make our own stuff, that
they
become
actually
a
lose money.
Yeah. It's a risk. It's a risk. There are people who are better at it. And I'm not sure the Apple name can spell good content. Right? A big thing there is Apple likes to win in everything it does. And content creation is so subjective. Can they really look at the numbers and say for sure that it's the right thing for them to be doing? I don't know. The idea of a film on the Apple label that falls flat, you know, it's a PR thing for the golden company out there.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good point. All right, this is the last article of our headlines. And this is really interesting. This was an article that Nilay Patel of The Verge wrote called "The Internet is Fucked, but We Can Fix It." And it's an editorial, but it's really fascinating editorial. I'm going to quote a little bit. I'm going to quote liberally from it here because he makes some great points. And I'm just sort of paraphrasing here and there. Massive companies like AT&T and Comcast have spent the first 2 months of 2014 boldly announcing plans to close and control the internet through additional fees, pay-to-play schemes, and sheer brutal size, all while the legal rules designed to protect these kinds of abuses were struck down in court for basically making too much sense. The companies that control the internet have continued down a dark path, free of any oversight or meaningful competition to check their behavior. In January, AT&T announced a new sponsored data plan that would dramatically alter the fierce one-click-away competition that's thus far characterized the internet, and we've covered that plan on the drill down. Earlier this month, Comcast announced plans to merge with Time Warner Cable, creating an internet service behemoth that will serve 40% of Americans in 19 of the 20 biggest markets with virtually no rivals. In a perfect storm of corporate greed and broken government, the internet has gone from vibrant center of the new economy to burgeoning tool of economic control. And the power of the new network industrial complex is immense and unchecked, even by other giants. AT&T blocked Apple's FaceTime and Google's Hangouts video chat services for the preposterously silly reason that the apps were preloaded on each company's phones instead of downloaded from an app store. "We're really, really fucking this up," he says. "Internet access isn't a luxury or a choice if you live and participate in the modern economy. It's a requirement. The internet isn't an adjunct to real life. It's not another place. You don't do things on the internet. You just do things. The network is interwoven into every moment of our lives, and we should treat it that way. Internet access is a utility, a commodity that should get better and faster and cheaper over time. Anyone who says otherwise is lying for money. The smartphone revolution was about putting a powerful computer and internet connection in everyone's pocket. It was not about creating a new class of economic gatekeepers with the unchecked power to control and destroy markets with zero oversight and little true competition." And he boils down the whole article into one paragraph here. He argues several things that he provides great arguments for each of these points. But let me just boil down this last paragraph here. He says, "Here's the entire problem expressed in four simple ideas. The internet is a utility. There is zero meaningful competition to provide that utility to Americans. All internet providers should be treated equally. And the FCC is doing a miserably ineffective job. The United States led the world in broadband deployment and speeds. We should have the lowest prices, the best service, and the most competition. We should have the freest speech and the loudest voices, the best debate, and the soundest policy. We are home to the most innovative technologies and companies in the world, and we should have the broadband networks to match. We should stop fucking it up." And he recommends as the fix for this to press hard against the FCC chairman, write and phone call to him. That's Tom Wheeler at FCC.gov. He posts a phone number on there to basically complain about the state of where we are right now and what the FCC, and essentially his idea is that FCC gets enough complaints from average Americans that they will.
It's calling your congressman, but the FCC is that person for
yes.
him. Only problem is the FCC chairman is appointed by the president. You can't change that person. Yeah. The only way to change that person is to change the president. If anyone thinks that there's going to be a president who's friendlier to the little people on the internet, like more than the guy we have now, that's a hard sell
yeah.
given the playing yeah. field, especially for the next time around. Hillary Clinton or what's his name with the Briggs situation? Chris Christie.
Yeah.
Both
oh,
of them are relatively moderate people, but they focus on business interests
yeah.
first.
Is that the overall problem? Is that the bigger overarching problem?
I'm not Nilay Patel. I don't spend my entire life, with punditry about the internet. I do it a couple times a week because I love it. So I don't have his breadth of expertise. I'm not going to pretend I do, but I, as a businessman, I look at what's going on the internet. And, you know, I think these companies have seen what they had undervalued as a service becoming a rich and deep part of culture, and they wish to monetize on it. On top of that, they look at what it takes to create these networks, which, you know, Nanda Patel doesn't mention at all. It's, you know, the software industry is blowing up in large part because these networks exist. And when you're a software pioneer, if you're a Zuckerberg or someone like that, you're sitting on a computer and you're typing away, and it's great that you can do this. But there are companies like AT&T who are on the ground who are building these networks and are doing it so at great expense. Now, I don't know how solvent they are. I don't know how not solvent they are. I don't know all those details right now. But if I'm an AT&T shareholder in this economy, I'm going to want AT&T to do what it can to get as much revenue as possible. And if that means a sponsored data plan, so your data plan is tied to an advertiser, then I'm going to see what I can do about that. If that means I'm going to begin to cap your stuff, that's great. Now, is this the best thing for freedom and openness on the internet? I don't know. But I do know that AT&T's purpose has never been freedom and openness on the internet. Its purpose has been, how can I make money off this internet thing that I provide for the rest of the world?
Of course.
So I'm not saying that AT&T is right or Nanda Patel is wrong. I'm just saying that the perspective they're coming at it is very different. Like, frankly, when you read that article, he does come across as a little entitled. Granted, we grew up with electricity and phones already being part of the actual utility scene. Running water, bathroom in the house, electricity, and telephone access were all things that were, by the early 1980s, mid to late 1970s, part of what it meant to be an American. But it wasn't always so. The internet hasn't been legislated. The government hasn't laid that out yet. It's still a luxury. It's still like a thing that hasn't been determined. And partly because it's an expensive thing. A broadband internet connection, a lot of Americans don't have them because they do run in the 60s and 70s of dollars a month. So is there price gouging going on? Maybe. Are these things expensive to put together? Definitely. I think what we need, and I think Nanda Patel would probably agree with me, is we need an in-depth look at the cost analysis of providing these networks, and the cost to the society if it becomes burdensome for the average American to be able to afford a reasonable broadband connection. Let's also think about the fact that, you know, a broadband connection allows for a couple things. Yes, it allows for, you know, people to write software and so on, but people are watching television and they're paying Netflix, and AT&T's like, it's on my network, I'm not getting any piece of this action. They're basically saying, this is happening on my turf, I'm not getting a piece of it. What do I have to do to get a piece of it? And that's what these seemingly string schemes are coming up with. A big piece of this is the paradigm that showed up with the internet came. The internet showed up, and all the geeks realized that so much stuff was possible for free out there. Traditional people were like, it's all stealing. The Netflix and Apple and all these other guys show up, and they show a better way where they can offer services and stuff at a price that people and with ease that people can afford. And AT&T and Comcast and Time Warner and some of these other guys, they're pretty late to the party, and they're trying to recoup costs. So that's a big piece of, I think, what's going on here. And frankly, what has to be done about it is, you know, real government insight. I think if, you know, the idea of an internet czar, looks like we have a terrorism czar, the FCC chairman doesn't seem to be it. It doesn't seem to be.
No.
He hasn't had the clout to pull it off. You know, courts have pulled back from him. Or
the FCC doesn't even seem like they want the job.
Well, they do want the job. Net neutrality was something the FCC went for. They really did go for it, and the court shut them down, and they're thinking about how to approach it again. But they're
not fighting very hard for it or defending it very, very well.
Well, they're not fighting very hard for it or defending it in a way that the young, very entitled people who use the internet a lot expect them to. they're managing politics. Luckily for them, you know, luckily and unluckily, they're not elected officials. Again, they're appointed.
Yeah.
Which means that courts can strike their stuff down and talk about what they're capable of doing, not capable of doing. Congress can legislate their scope. You know, there's a lot of bureaucracy in between an FCC chairman wanting something and actually getting something. Mm-hmm. To stand up and have a bully pulpit and yada, yada, yada when you're part of a presidential administration simply doesn't really happen. You don't see, you know, if you're the Secretary of State, if you're the Secretary of Defense, you might, you know, you'll end up on the, what's it called? On the, on like Meet the Press and these other places like that. But FTC chairman, they're not top of mind or they don't have that kind of profile status. So the fact that they're not fighting, I don't know what they're doing. But it's pretty clear that they don't have the power to tell what's in half.
Yeah.
To deal with. They don't want the job or yada, yada, yada. They want the job. They're there. They're not simple cronies.
Are they not?
Going up against very real industry issues and money that they don't have. So when AT&T goes into a lawsuit like this, and the FCC has to go to the Justice Department or whoever, and you know, or the administration asks for money to fight against these lawsuits, they're not getting the same caliber lawyers, they're not getting the same caliber this, that, and other thing. So, you know, there's a lot here, and a big piece of it, again, is the internet just kind of showed up one day, and our government is struggling to figure out how to quantify and legislate around it. Still, to this day, 20 years in. But frankly, 20 years is not a whole bunch of time when you consider how long it's taken them to figure out everything else. So I just think we're in a quagmire, and the problem isn't, oh, this guy's to blame or that guy's to blame. The problem is working on figuring out the best way to manage the needs of new technologies when they arise in a government that hasn't been prepared for them ever. The only technology that this government has ever been prepared for was the gun, the firearm, which in its inception, it included in the Bill of Rights. And we still have trouble with that today.
Yeah, you know what? I think one of the real baseline cases that he does point out that is really interesting to think about is how on the surface. So I know on the back end there's been a lot of changes, but on the surface, how much innovation do we at least get to witness? It always seems like, and maybe it's just the mantra or style of these companies to be very closed rather than sort of open, which is kind of, I guess, somewhat the nature of the internet. We never really get to hear much about what's going on, what sort of changes are happening. And I think he brings up Google Fiber because it seems like finally there is some sort of competition, and it also sounds to a certain extent that Google is using the same sort of framework they use with their other applications where, you know, they have a blog. They give us a little bit more insight into, you know, potentially why they made some decisions and maybe even some of the struggles. I think if the large corporate organizations are going to succeed, and by this I really mean, like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years down the road, I think they're really going to have to sort of change their style, especially how they deal with, you know, quote unquote, the consumer or their customer.
I'm pretty sure that companies won't need to do that. Companies can do whatever they want. But I think that what you're saying is really applicable for governments. If the government wants to effectively petition, you know, if the government wants to effectively engage the people about these issues, about any issues, they've got to do a lot more with the internet to talk about what they want to do. And a big piece of that is, you know, letting people know what's up, what's coming, why is it coming, what's the thought process behind it. People don't want to see the finished product anymore. People want to be wowed, fine, but they also want to feel like they're participants. That's what the internet's always been about.
Yeah.
And if you're running an internet company right now, you don't have a blog, or you're one of those CEOs who's afraid of a blog or whatever, that's an issue that you really have to get around. And the same goes for the government. I'm not saying, you know, obviously the office of the president is just so high and mighty, you can't have him spouting out whatever he thinks that night before he goes to bed. But
although he has done a Reddit, AMA and other things.
He has, yeah. And I mean, he's been both praised and like made fun of because of it. But there needs to be some sort of outlet where the people, you know, politically, I'm thinking, at least feel like they're a part of it or a witness to the process. That's what it is, witness to the process, right? And I mean, these processes happen, and maybe it's a question of disclosure after a decision has come out. We changed the Affordable Care Act because of XYZ or ABC. I think you're right. I don't think that companies won't survive if they don't engage the way you talk about. I think they can, because they can strong arm and they can do back channel. How many oil companies do you know are communicating with the consumer? Not many. But how many oil companies do you know, or energy companies in general, coal, whatever, are able to control legislation and you know, influence all sorts of stuff that impact our lives? If you have the capital, you don't need to engage the way you would otherwise. In politics, you have to build social capital, political welfare. So I do think that what you're saying applies. And the FCC chairman would do well to keep a blog helping people understand what's up, because the internet culture is only going to grow. It's only going to get bigger. The need for people to have access and do things, like Manny Patel said, is only going to become more and more of a utility and need. Yeah. And government has to, if they want to be strong, if they want to maintain power, they're going to have to help with that.
We're going to take one last break here. And when we come back, Google isn't content with just mapping the streets. They want to map everything. Our drill down video of the week is next. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cersini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakin. Google this week announced Project Tango, an Android-based prototype 5-inch phone and developer kit with advanced 3D sensors out of its Advanced Technology and Projects Skunkworks group, the ATAP group. Using its sensors, the phone doesn't track motion, but it can actually build a visual map of rooms using 3D scanning. Google believes a combination of these sensors with advanced computer vision techniques will open up new avenues for indoor navigation and immersive gaming, among many other things. Beginning this week, Google will allow developers to sign up for access for these phones. The first one will be limited to a group of 200 developers who are handpicked by Google. Developers will have to provide Google with a clear idea of what they want to build with the device, and the company expects to allocate all devices by the middle of March. It will send the devices to developers who want to build apps for indoor navigation mapping, single multiplayer games that use physical space, algorithms for processor sensing data. The idea behind Project Tango is to see what kind of applications developers will dream up with the technology. Google hopes that it can unlock new kinds of smart vision-based applications based on the 3D sensing and vision technology built into the phone. The phones are outfitted with a compass and a gyros, just like any other phone. But in addition, they feature Kinect-like visual sensors that can scan the room around the phone. So it's basically like having a handheld connect. But add on to that, like, the
Microsoft's Xbox Kinect is the technology you're talking about. The technology that allows the computer to look at what's going on in the room, measure changes, and then respond based on that.
Right. Okay. But also add to that the potential to connect to Google's cloud, and the potential is phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like the phone is cool for that, but, like, you just bought Nest. Put that in the Nest Protect, put that in the Nest Thermostat, and then draw rooms like that.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it will, I mean, the potential, we're just scratching the surface. The guy who's behind this is Johnny Chung Lee, and I don't know if that name sounds familiar to you or not, but a few years ago he made waves in his internet circles, because he was doing some really cutting edge stuff with Wii remotes, using Wii remotes for head tracking.
Yeah, he's the guy who, like, took the Wii remote and put it, like, he reversed it. He, like, put it on his glasses.
Uh huh.
And that way, and he put the actual remote on, like, in a fixed position.
Yep.
And his moving was sort of like a Kinect that kind of drew the area, the space for him. That was pretty cool. Pretty young guy, pretty innovative.
Yeah. So now he's behind this Project Tango, and man, I just can't wait to see what this is. We're just scratching the surface, and the fact this is all handheld.
Stuff like this makes me never want to die. What am I gonna miss?
Right. Right. There's a video attached of the sort of the introduction to the Project Tango, and that's our video of the week that we're going to have in the show notes. And just everyone just needs to check it out, because you see this and you just get excited about what potential this has, what's coming up. And, you know, like I said, it's just the idea of connecting this to Google's cloud, or the idea of having something like this integrated into Google Glass. It's just you're just opening up a world of possibilities of applications for this technology.
Well, the cool part is, it's like, you don't need to have this thing on your face, Google Glass, that's gonna single you out as a this what? Kind of person or that kind of person, uh-huh. Glass hole, whatever the term you want to use. It's just a phone.
Yeah.
With new capabilities that you can use to do cool things without getting in the way, you know, without kind of, I don't know, you're not being a tech show off. That's kind of cool. Yeah.
Anyway, that is it for our show, with the exception of going around the room here, and I'll start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work on the internet when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Check out what I have to say on twitter.com/DwayneD. Always hit up gplus.to/DwayneD. That's my Google Plus account. And you can find me here on the Drill Down.
And Tosin, how about yourself? How about where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. IRCwebcast.blogspot.com. We'll be in a couple months. We'll have some rebranding coming back strong. And, of course, toastr2d2.tumblr.com for all R2D2 happenings.
Love it.
Yeah, I'm down with that. What about you, Andy? Where can we find you?
I am at Twitter and Facebook at Mr. Babyman. You could just Google Mr. Babyman, and you'll find all of my work online. That's my social network handle. And as far as the Drill Down goes, if you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about, or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com. for us to publish on the site. You can let us help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com and pitch us what you want to sell, and we'll sell it on the show, as we do with the Audible subscription. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location, when our guest will be Matt Hawkins, president of Top Cow Comics. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.